North-South Connection Podcast Network. Here we are again. My name is Aaron, and thank you for joining us for episode 29 of The Year That Was. I didn't mean to say us. I meant to say me, but us. I didn't mean the royal us. I'm not pretentious like that. I'm just grateful anybody's listening, so thank you for your continued support. Anybody who supported either the North-South Connection Podcast Network or this show, The Year That Was, I can't tell you how much it means to me that this thing has any listeners at all, and any comments and feedback you guys have sent my way, I can't thank you enough. We're in episode 29. My goodness, we're almost done. It'll be 29 out of 36. And today, we are dealing with the eighth best year of pay-per-views in the WWE WWF history, right? Interesting, when they used to make fun of WCW saying it like that, but Vince always said WWF. It's only in later years where it became WWE. Quick refresher if you're new to the podcast. I hope that if you're new and this is the first one you're listening to, you'll give the past episodes a chance. I do think they've gotten better with time. But, you know, I'm sure there's still some value in the original ones. What I did was I took, I didn't say I took 3 years. It's not like I put the 3 years aside. But I watched every single WWE pay-per-view and ranked every match in every year and then put the years against each other. And the result is this list. We started in April of last year with the worst year in WWF history, which was 1995. We're working our way to the number one. And today, we are dealing with the number eight, the eighth best year, which is 1991. So, in 1991, I was 11 years old. And my dad would often take me to the video store to rent tapes. My local video store was called Video Mania, which I guess is the equivalent of Video Mania. So he would take me there, and my video store had like this whole rack, well, at least a couple rows of WWF tapes. Because in Canada, it took a long time, where I'm from, it took a long time to get pay-per-view. If I'm not mistaken, the first pay-per-view that we were actually able to order was the 1992 Royal Rumble. And I did order, that was the first pay-per-view I ordered, but I actually think it was the first one available. And I mean, look, you could do a lot worse as a first pay-per-view than that. But all we had in terms of quote-unquote live wrestling was Superstars on Saturday morning. And then on, I live in Quebec, and on Ontario, we had an Ontario channel sometimes in the late afternoon from Cornwall, Ontario. We'd get Maple Leaf Wrestling, which was kind of like a shittier Superstars or like a revamp. But we didn't get primetime. There's no wrestling challenge, just jobber match after jobber match. And it was glorious. Look, if you're lucky enough to have the English sports station, I couldn't get it where I was located. I was on the south shore of Montreal. But if you're lucky enough to have that English sports station, you would get the AWA. But no kid my age at 11 wanted to watch that shit, right? Like, my room was adorned. Like to give you an idea of what a fan I was, my room was adorned with, like, Hulk Hogan posters, Ultimate Warrior posters. I once bought a WWF championship belt at a live event and wore it to school, which I'm sure added 6 to 8 months to my virginity. So I was a super fan. But, like, even then, like, I mean, think of how I'm still a super fan, I guess, because I'm choosing to, like, produce these shows rather than spend time with my family and children and all that. But all that to say, me, a super fan, turned on AWA at my babysitter's house one day. I was like, oh, it's too dark. And, like, it made me, like, I kind of banished it from my mind the way I did the Long Finger Man. So I don't think anyone was really into the AWA that much. Anyway, back to my dad. When at this age, I mean. Sure, I'm sure I'd like it now. Back to my dad, though. Certain times we'd rent tapes. My dad would rent an extra VCR. And when that happened, it was on. And if I dig through some boxes I have right now, I'm sure I still have the copied versions of WrestleMania 7, SummerSlam 91, Survivor Series 91, and This Tuesday in Texas, which I think was on Super Tape 92 or something like that. For some reason, I didn't have the Rumble. I don't know why, but I watched the shit out of these tapes. And look, I know I'm hard on a team like the Natural Disasters, and we're going to talk about them at some point, but probably more when we do 1992. But it's because I've seen their matches like a bajillion times. These were my weekends. This was the background music when I had my wrestling federation with my figures, right? I'd throw on a tape and I'd do my own thing, right? And to this day, If I throw them on and I hear the soothing sounds of Gorilla and Bobby, man, I am right back there. I'm right back with my father, like, yelling at the wires aren't long enough, or he's demanding to know how I got fingerprints on the ceiling. This year, 1991, for me, is pure nostalgia. It's comfort food. And, you know, I think I've told you guys when I've, there's some years, like, for instance, one of the last years I watched for 2019. Yeah, one of the last years I watched Departed 2019, I think it took me a month and a half to get through it all, right? When I sat down to rewatch 1991, I think I did it in like 3 nights, you know, just pounded them out. That's how much fun it was to do. And I hope, let's unpack it, right? So a couple through lines. Number one, it's cool that they're starting to elevate new people and they seem to be moving in a different direction. Number two, everything on screen matters. Everything is tied into a story. Very little happens just because. And the biggest through line, I think, is, man, this stuff's getting dark. 91's a weird year for dark shit. Let's hear from Dave Hall. Dave, so anybody who writes in, guys, I love it. My favorite part of the show. Without even, it's not a Krusty the Clown. Talk to the audience. It's not that. I love it because it lets me fly a bit off the cuff. But I just love the participation aspects of the show. So Dave Hall. I was a little surprised to see this year so high until I thought about it a bit more. 1991 is the year that WWF started focusing on guys who could produce really good in-ring matches, like Bret Hart. They signed Ric Flair, one of the best ever, and focused on some really strong storylines. Jake Roberts versus the Macho Man, Ric Flair's the real world champion, and his battles with Piper and Hogan. 1991 marked a change of direction for the company and a move away from the muscle-bound headliners. Good year, but I see it more as a setup year for the one that follows. Yeah, I think that's fair, Dave, and I think that's probably the reason why we haven't seen the one that follows yet, if you know what I mean. Thanks for writing in. Listen, if you're, I break it down in 12 categories, and that's what makes the cumulative ranking for the year that was. So the first category I look at is matches, and matches this year finished 19th out of 36. An average star rating of 2.87 out of 48 matches. And I think the thing that kind of amazes me about all these older years is when you look at them, there really is a lack of like the all-time bad matches. There's no Punjabi prison nonsense. There's no Vince beating up his daughter. There's no stuff that's completely business exposing. There's no... Oh, so preposterous and over the top that I like the Randy Orton, John Cena, Iron Man match. There's none of that in here, right? My worst match for the year clocks in at 1.75 stars, and there's only one of them. And there's only 6 other matches that I would even consider bad. Now, for me, the bad is anything under 2.5 stars. Now, the trade-off for that in these years, and this is pretty true through all these years, is there's very few truly great matches. And there's like a dearth of mediocre matches. Now, I think the reason why this happens and the reason why I think more why there's not bad matches and maybe because why there's not so great ones too. I think it's a combination of two things. I think first, because kayfabe was alive and well and not raped at the bottom of a ravine, guys cared about protecting the business. And because of this, most of the stuff you see ends up looking pretty legit. The wrestlers are professionals. Now, we all make fun of Jim Duggan now. We're like, he was terrible or whatever, right? But I don't know if there's a guy on the roster right now that throws a punch as good as old Hacksaw, right? So they're all good professional wrestlers. They aren't sports entertainers or superstars. I mean, they are superstars since everyone in the company at this point is just as over as Gaston in that Beauty and the Beast bar, right? And look, I'm going to be honest. It sucks that Gaston was killed by that beast. The town is fucked without him. He feeds everyone. He keeps them safe. And like we're supposed to rejoice that a one percenter in a castle is going to suddenly have everything again. He gets the most beautiful girl. He gets the best. Didn't Gaston deserve the best? Anyway, the other reason I think that we have a lack of bad matches, besides the fact that these guys are all professionals and they tried to make it look legit for kayfabe, is that every match on the show, everyone, like a very high percentage, is meaningful and matters. And they usually all have solid stories behind them. And if they don't, they're quick and they're used to build somebody up. So those two factors, for me, immediately makes everything more watchable. And now that I've talked about things being watchable, let's talk about the worst match of the year. So the worst match of the year. Just in general, this is a really rough Survivor Series in 1991, which is a shame because it might be the tape that I watched the most as a kid. I guess I just always shut it off after the Hogan match. And the thing that bugs me about it is Survivor Series matches are usually pretty hard to mess up. See, because you got a bunch of guys tagging in and out. There's no time for bullshit. It's all action. You know, very little rest holds, lots of different combinations, and lots of potential to create storylines out of the matches. So usually they're not hard. In this one, three of my sevens that don't make that threshold which they're talking about, so anything 2.25 or lower, are Survivor Series matches. And I think that the main event has like my personal nightmare team of IRS and the Natural Disasters. And look, if that team doesn't want to make you put on White Christmas and slit your wrists, thank your lucky stars that you haven't felt real pain in your life. Speaking of real pain, there's also a match with the Nasty Boys and the Bushwhackers in it. But that's still not the worst match of the year. So the worst match of the year, for me, the team of Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Sergeant Slaughter, the Texas Tornado, and El Matador Tito Santana versus Colonel Mustafa, the Berserker Skinner, Hercules Survivor Series match from the Survivor Series. It's the second match on the show. So I threw this on. Here's what I thought of it. And right away, what a weird collection of people the heel team is. I don't know at what point Mr. Fuji went to Scandinavia to recruit the Berserker, but I don't understand how they don't have footage of that trip. And I'll also say Hercules has a lot of balls wearing that handlebar mustache in the same company as Hulk Hogan. I give old Linda Beale a lot of shit for having Buddy Landell as the Nature Boy and dressing exactly like Ric Flair. But man, I'm surprised Hercules didn't get punished for that mustache. Kerry Von Erich comes out. He's clearly talking to himself. He's stumbling on the ring apron. And I don't know why, but for some reason now, because Tito Santana's a matador, now he's not running to... He used to always run to the ring in that t-shirt, pumping his fist. Now he's... It's like he went through a King Booker-esque transformation. Is it because he's carrying that ball of wool? But it's all changed. Also, Slaughter's coming down, like, you know, waving the flag he literally wanted to burn earlier in the year. Guy just wants country back, man. And I love Gorilla saying, Slaughter is a great American. Like... How is he a great American? Like, it's such bullshit. What shouldn't the great Americans be the ones that didn't turn their back on the country? Like, in Gorilla's mind, why isn't Skinner a great American? Like, in my mind, he's certainly a better American than Sergeant Slaughter. He didn't ally himself with Saddam Hussein. He just kills alligators. We don't want alligators. Tito hits the flying jalapeno earlier. I maybe it's me, and maybe it's because I'm watching some NWA and Stan Hansen's there, but it must have sucked to wrestle guys with the chewing tobacco. It's got to get everywhere. Gorilla and Bobby have this great discussion that stuck with me all these years later, whether Tito's tights are iridescent green or iridescent guacamole. Man, Bobby Heenan will be canceled today. Berserker does the worst jump I've ever seen. He lands on his heels, then his ass. Mustafa is just not giving a fuck anymore. He's just straight up wearing the Iron Sheik boots. And am I to believe that when Slaughter got it, did he return the boots to Saddam Hussein when he got his, like, and how would Saddam have taken that? Like, he gifted those. He's gonna send that gift back to this benevolent dictator. Duggan comes in the ring. He's in there less than a minute. He's thrown no less than 65 punches. And I don't understand what the company's obsession with the name Mustafa is. Colonel Mustafa, comma Mustafa, Mustafa Ali. It's enough. Notice I'm not talking about the match that much because it's just so fucking boring, right? Slaughter then comes in and hits Mustafa with one clothesline and pins him. All right. Slaughter then injures the Berserker's penis and Gorilla starts talking about him singing in an octave higher. Then this whole Berserker in peril sequence has gone on way too long. Santana then comes in, he hits Hercules in the stomach. Herc has to sell it for like, I don't know, 25 seconds, but it's long. It's like the pedigree at WrestleMania 19. Then Tito hits the downward forearm, which Gorilla calls El Paso del Monte. And I don't appreciate at all how when Tito pins him, his legs are, he's almost doing the splits lying down. I don't like it. Slaughter then just rolls up Skinner out of nowhere. Berserker's left against the whole team. Slaughter bashes his head 10 times into the exposed turnbuckle. It feels like that should be like an attempted murder situation. 3 points dance from Duggan, beats the Berserker. Duggan then jumps for joy like he's just won the world title. Like, you just beat a bunch of nobodies. Then he does this weird jumping dance, waving. Look, I'm not going to sit here and say this was the worst match of all time. Clearly it's not. By God, it was boring. And I don't know. The whole Slaughter getting his country back is just freaking ridiculous. All right, top five matches of the year. So many times, like again, in a year like this, there's not a lot of four-star matches, so there's no honorable mentions. Let's go to top five. Number five, from this Tuesday in Texas, the Macho Man, Randy Savage versus Jake the Snake Roberts. I have it at 3.5 stars. I think it's a beautiful thing when the congruence between the hate that lies in my heart and the hate that is presented in a television product, when that comes together, man, there's nothing better, you know? And this match is pure hate. Savage hadn't wrestled since Mania and comes out with the intention of murdering Jake Roberts. And I love that it's quick and to the point and the right guy went over. This match feels like the reverse mirror image of the WrestleMania 25 main event between Triple H and Randy Orton. See, both Triple H and Savage had their wives assaulted by their opponent or harassed. But Savage never once looked like he was coming to prove his worth in a wrestling match and trying to pin his shoulders to the mat, even though he did. He fucking beats the shit out of Jake, and there's so much urgency to the beating. There's no lockups, it's not 25 minutes long, it's just a guy assaulting another guy for ruining his wedding with a snake. And the post-match stuff is all-time good. He DDTs Savage a bunch of times, all the while he's making the dude's wife watch too, which is, I mean, such a great... wonderful touch. And then Jake slaps Elizabeth, and this drives Savage over the edge. And imagine Randy Macho Man Savage not being over the edge and then going over the edge. That's how great this story was. Fourth best match of the year. Ric Flair, Ted DiBiase, the Warlord and the Mountie versus Roddy Piper, Virgil, Bret Hart, and Davey Boy Smith at the Survivor Series. Again, 3.5 stars. So this was our first look at Ric Flair, and it was great. And imagine, look at this match. Look at the talent and Virgil in this match. And I love that everyone was paired up with their dance partners kind of going forward, or in the past in some cases. Flair and DiBiase carry the work for the heels, and they're both excellent in the match. I shit on DiBiase a lot, but he's good. He's good in this match quite a bit. And I feel like this is the most motivated Piper had been in the ring since, I don't know, 1987. He's electric, man. Like, I guess I'd never really seen him at his full potential. But he's so much fun to watch in this thing. All his sequences with Flair where he's punching him, the eye pokes, the Flair flops. As a kid, I love this shit, right? And even at the end where everyone's fighting on the outside and not following the rules and everyone gets disqualified except for Ric Flair, I get why some people might not like it, but I think it's cool. It's unique. I also like that they... They also had to, like, he had to run away, like, just to make sure he didn't get beat up more. Great action, fantastic character stuff. Easy winner for me. I've watched this match a lot. I love it. Number three, best match of the year. Mr. Perfect versus Bret Hart from the SummerSlam Intercontinental title match. I have it at 3.5 stars. So I know I'm a bit lower on this one than most. And I like it. I think it's very good. I just think that their 1993 King of the Ring match is about a billion times better. But this was such a cool crowning moment for Bret, and Perfect made him look like $1 million. I don't know why Lord Alfred Hayes cuts off Stu Hart immediately after asking him a question. If anyone knew why Lord Alfred hated Stu, let me know. I mean, maybe he was stretched. Maybe he was humbled. Did Stu tell him that, like, with your British voice, you should be calling Formula One rather than wrestling? Nigel Mansell is racing Ayrton Senna. Whatever the reason, I guess we'll never know the cause because Hayes is dead. And if there's a heaven, Lord Alfred Hayes is not in it. Number two best match of the year, the Rockers versus the Orient Express, Royal Rumble, 3.75. It's just a fantastic tag match. Sadly, I think it's the best Rockers tag match on pay-per-view. And I don't mean that to slag this match. I think it's just, I feel like we were robbed of a lot of really great Rockers matches. The action is fast-paced. I just wish we had a bigger catalog of Rockers matches to go back to on pay-per-view. The number one match of the year. The Macho Man, Randy Savage. Actually, the King, Macho King, Randy Savage. Versus the Ultimate Warrior. Retirement match from WrestleMania 7. Easy 5 stars for me. I have this as the third
best match of all time in the company. And I mean, what more can I say about this match that hasn't already been said by both smarter and stupider people, right? What I do love about it, aside from everything else, is that I love that it plays off the spiral that Randy Savage had been on since he lost the title at WrestleMania 5. So he loses the belt. He ends up getting Sherry to counter Elizabeth, right? And he just ends up getting repeatedly humbled by Hogan, not in the Iron Sheik version, just getting pinned. And so he ends up going for a lesser prize, which is the crown, and he wins it. But it's this weird wallowing as like this year as king. He's going after Dusty Rhodes. He's kind of a bit directionless as the king, right? Then he decides he wants to go for the title again. He gets desperate for the shot. And I don't know why the Warriors refusing the shot for him. I don't get it. But he gets more desperate, so he his psychopathy gets the best of him. And he fucks with the Warrior, who goes on to retire him, right? Like, had he never come back, I think this match is kind of the perfect end to his career. He was always crazy, and now his craziness is what ends up being his undoing. And the match is incredible. The reunion at the end with Elizabeth is perfect. But the part that always gets me every single time is at the end, Liz tries to hold the ropes open for him, and he refuses and holds the ropes for her. It's such a great, it's full circle. It's such a great full circle thing that I feel like no one told him to do this. I'm sure he came up with it. But like, you know, he spent the early parts of his career demanding that she would do it, but now he's changed. He realizes that like the title and the revenge and all the things he was focused on, it didn't matter. What mattered was her, right? He found again the most important thing of his life. And this is a really deep story for a wrestling thing. But I think that's why it's so effective, right? And the best part is that he opens the ropes for her and she exits the ring. And then he takes a step back in the ring. And now he puts his arms out. And for the first time in 2 years, the crowd is losing it for him. And you can tell he feels it. And it feels like a goodbye, right? Like no one ever hated him as king. He's just an asshole character, right? So everyone was just happy for him to be good again and happy to say goodbye to him in the best way. Man, it's such a great redemption story. The fans always loved him, and Savage basking in the farewells of that crowd in that night in Los Angeles is easily one of my favorite moments in the history of wrestling. Just watch that last section when he closes the rope, she leaves, and he turns to the crowd. Listen to that pop and listen to his reaction to it. Awesome. What a saga. Speaking of sagas, every Sunday on the North South Connection Podcast Network, Remzo Martinez, Mark Clare, Second Print Comics, they just dealt with the Phoenix saga in the comics world. But give this show a chance if you haven't already. These guys are awesome to listen to. Great chemistry. And after every big match, every big pay-per-view event, we got viewer's choice. Tim, the Not Tool Man, Marcus Fuller, they go at it. They stay up late into the night to review these shows for you to make sure that you get to hear all about it, get a nice solid review. And Tim and Marcus are a lot of fun to listen to also. So viewer's choice after every big event, and Second Print Comics every, my God, it's every Sunday. Yeah, it's actually every Sunday on the North South Connection Podcast Network. Check it out. Moving on, the next category that we rank I keep saying we. It's not the Royal We. I promise it's not the Royal We. The next category is characters, and I have this 9th out of 36. Can we talk about the goddamn Mountie? This man is so proud that he has earned his spot in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that he repeatedly takes time out of his matches to scream that he is in fact a Mountie to the audience. And he's such a despicable piece of shit in the role that the actual Mounties got angry. I mean, I guess if you're a cop in a bright red jacket riding a horse, you don't really have the best sense of humor. Incidentally, if they arrest someone with the horse, what do they do? Does he just get on the back of the horse and ride him in? Look, I love all of it. Jacques Rougeau is a national treasure. El Matador, Tito Santana. So Tito Santana, I guess he's tired of his losing ways. Decides to go back to his roots, or his rus, as Bobby Heenan would say. Don the iridescent green or iridescent guacamole tights with the bright pink foot pads, I guess. Tie his hair like as tight as a fucking... It looks like his head's going to explode and become a matador. Is this the first other sport gimmick in company history? I can't remember any others because you got Abe Knuckleball Schwartz later. You get, I don't know, other guys later. I think Cesaro was a rugby player, some bullshit like that. But this whole business with Tito Santana needing a new coat of paint is such a ridiculous notion considering how good Tito Santana is. Sergeant Slaughter is a traitor. You know who doesn't get talked about enough, though, as a traitor is Colonel Mustafa. The guy just straight up switches from Iran to Iraq. Why? Was that Adnan guy that good a recruiter? Because Iran and Iraq were at war until 1988. Perhaps Mustafa was a prisoner of war who had been reprogrammed to walk like a bushwhacker? Why would he start walking like that? Maybe that's how the Iraqis tortured their POWs? They sit there and they make them watch bushwhacker matches? How many times the poor Iron Sheik, like how many times was he blasted with a fire hose as Butch jerked off one of the Rougeos at Mania 5? I guess that's why he's fucking insane today. Nasty Boys, look, they feel like the garbage pail kids of wrestling. Like, I just wanted to collect the cards, but the thought of spending any time with them, no. And I, you know, you don't trust anybody from Pity City. Why did Vince McMahon hate Ricky Steamboat? Did we need to dress him up like a literal dragon? Thank God they didn't take the same tact with Greg Valentine. Imagine getting Ricky Steamboat back in 1991, right? Like, he's just had this incredible NWA run. Some of the greatest matches of all time. Tyler Kelly, Place to Be Nation, has they had to finish the Stretch Project Greatest Matches. Three of the top five Ricky Steamboat matches. So this is who Vince is getting back in 1991. You don't put him in feuds. No, you put him in scales. You have him breathe fire instead of wrestling matches. IRS is maybe the most boring wrestler of all time. And my early watching NWA days have confirmed this to me. I will say I do always get a kick out of his pre-match promos. He's just an asshole. Like, pay your taxes! I can't imagine a scenario in which this character could ever be a face. Why couldn't Steve Kern just be a wrestler? Why do you have to be a pedophile? And why would we have a pedophile on TV? I like having bad guys in wrestling, but I don't want to see characters in a show for kids that I wouldn't leave my kids around for more than a heartbeat. All I remember from Dusty Rhodes' 1991 is Vince screaming, "They're beating your son! They're beating your son!" When you get so much, it gets so much funnier for me when you realize he's the booker. I'm your boss. I'm going to make my other employees kick the shit out of your son. Oh, yeah, and then I'm going to make that your son there, I'm going to make him a gold homosexual. And then later say he's just Andronymous and just playing mind games. He's not an actual homosexual. And then I'll put him in silver and red and force a gag ball gag in his mouth. Then I'll have my top star throw him in the toilet. Why did Vince McMahon hate Dusty Rhodes so much? And why did Vince McMahon hate Tony Atlas? Do we need a smiling Kamala? No, Kamala was fine as the chicken eater. That was offensive enough. We didn't need another guy in toes and a mask and dancing around like that. Hulk Hogan is fine, I guess, this year. He's not wearing a giant fist on his head, so I'm happy. Honestly, this is probably the last year in which he faces no babyface backlash until 2002. Ted DiBiase. For some reason in my notes, I just realized I wrote it as Red DiBiase. And I wish that they did a storyline where he had like a fucking poor brother named Red DiBiase. Damn it, Red, I can't help you out anymore. So Ted DiBiase is an asshole to the highest degree. Would not help his brother Red, not for one second. He hated his brother. His brother was always better than him at everything. But now Ted made it big, so Red is just out of luck. How poorly did he pay Virgil all these years for him to need the job to have to keep putting up with the abuse? DiBiase is just out ruining lives, plain and simple. Just let the man quit his job. You're bigger and stronger than him. Hire Red. Red needs the money. I like Virgil. I like his music. I love that. I like the boxing shorts. I like him doing his jabs. I like all of it. It's a shame, though. This feels like a character that could never move past DiBiase once the feud was over. Reminds me, actually, a lot of Marty Jannetty with Shawn Michaels. Like, his he never had an identity, Virgil. And Marty too, but Virgil never had an identity that existed without the Million Dollar Man. I mean, I guess he's over as the Olive Garden guy now, but I guess maybe there were no Olive Gardens in 1991. Tugboat starts the year, I guess, as a living boat. They're calling him Boat. He toots like a boat. He dresses like an asshole. Then after repeated beatings at the hand of Earthquake, he just jumps up and says, I'm not a boat anymore. Now I'm a windstorm. And from here on out, I'm gonna help other boats to shore. And fuck it, I'm going to start squishing guys. My God, imagine the poor woman going home with the natural disasters. The emergence of Ric Flair really enhances the character of Bobby Heenan on commentary. He's always great. He's always funny as color commentator. But giving him a guy to rally, because he always cheered for the heels. But giving him a guy to really rally behind worked better than anyone could have hoped. And watching him get humiliated with the real world championship at the SummerSlam is great. He just plays it off so well. You don't know what you're doing. I'm sure John Tolos was good somewhere and sometime, but why on earth would Mr. Perfect need this dude all decked out in white? It's such a downgrade. Perfect's fine. He doesn't need him. Bret Hart was just the cool guy. He doesn't really have that much more of a character. The LOD were monsters. Again, it's enough for me. Jim Neidhart, clearly a lonely man. And how could he not be? As soon as they lost the titles to those dirtbags, his attractive friend dumped his ass. There was a Viking running around screaming, Huss. To this day, this is the wrestler I've showed each of my children so that my children will scream, Huss, and yell it at my wife. Fred Katao was a thing. And I remember at the time thinking Tenryu was like the super badass. This was, of course, before he failed to comprehend the idea of a bounty. Davey Boy Smith was trotting out a new dog to the ring. That might have been late 90, but in 91 he had him too. And are these bulldogs not sad enough looking, like actual bulldogs? Now we either have to imagine that Winston is cuckling Matilda or Matilda's just dead. And no one wants to think about dead animals while we're watching a wrestling show. Never mind a dead dog. No one finds a dead dog funny. I've tried it in every comedic situation and no one laughs at a dead dog. Except one time at an improv show when I had to yell out an object someone found in a garage for the people to act out, and I said dead dog. And then they didn't do it. Speaking of dead animals, frankly, Frankie probably died of shame after the trash talking at the Royal Rumble from Jimmy Hart. Oh, what do you think about that, Frankie? who thinks to trash talk a bird? The Undertaker is a dead guy. Nothing can hurt. He makes children cry. So he's really, a perfect wrestling character. He locks the Warrior in a coffin, which prompts the Warrior to just tear the shit out of the lining. Now, this in turn prompted 11-year-old me to write a grade 5 essay called Has Wrestling Gone Too Far? I guess at the time, I wouldn't have fathomed that we get to corpse fucking. But then again, I also never thought that Hunter Hearst Helmsley would have been a world champion. What do I know? I mentioned Randy Savage's career arc earlier, but I loved in 1991 that he seems, in storyline-wise anyway, he's content with his life. And then a guy starts fucking with his wife and he's pulled back in. And this will eventually lead to him in 1992 winning the championship. But I love that after winning Elizabeth back, she becomes the lightning rod for all of his stories. Let's finish up the character section talking about Jake the Snake Roberts. What is this fucking guy's problem, man? He's burying guys up to their necks in a full room of snakes? Is that his home? Because if that's not his home, where does this room exist with the dirt and the snakes where he puts the Ultimate Warrior? Where does one find a room full of snakes where you can bury a man? Then he's crashing weddings. Again, I don't know why, right? He never really shown an affinity for Randy Savage one way or another. Maybe he just wasn't invited. When my buddy didn't invite me to his wedding, I unfriended him on Facebook and made sure he was unemployable. I didn't bring a box with a snake in it to his wedding. Then he attacks the guy who got married a couple months later with a King Cobra. This is fucking insane. A giant King Cobra biting a man within 10 feet of the audience. Why was the audience... I'm rewatching that. There's that kid crying in the Hulkamania shirt, and with good reason. That's fucking scary. But why is the rest of the audience not worried this snake is going to just start going crazy? This has to be the most evil thing. The snake is biting Randy Savage. He's biting him! For God's sake, get Randy Savage out of there! This has got to be the most evil thing done on WWF TV. And, this is a show that had a man feed another man his own dog, right? And next, Jake's popping up in Bill Cosby sweaters, talking about the end being the beginning and all that shit. The whole thing is pure insanity. And Jake was so brilliant at it, man. I guess the year before he snapped was a pretty big, rough year for him. I mean, first he's fighting this guy with rats. Then he loses his vision with an asshole who sprayed him with perfume. And then finally a very large man murdered his pet on television and then ate him. You know, I don't think it gets talked about enough that the killing of Damien pushes him over the edge. And he's just like, fuck it. I'm going to start ruining lives. You know, you know what this act needs? It needs more snakes, more dangerous snakes. Jake Roberts in 1991, 1992 is sheer brilliance. I love it so much. Easily one of the best characters they have ever, ever, ever done. Let me hear from Steve Van Kooten. All right, Steve checks in and says, 1991 had an air of instability to it, even with all the self-correction with the world heavyweight title. Hogan is at the top again, a living Johnsonville sausage, constantly seeping meat juice out of every well-braised pore. Good Lord. Steven's getting poetic. Sergeant Slaughter managed to have one of the most unlikely main event runs ever and acquitted himself quite well at Mania and in the Desert Storm match. It's good there's no mention of the rest of the year. Savage manages to be the MVP of the year despite being retired for a great portion of it and displaying the fashion sense of a 1990s hip-hop band. He looked like a Timothy Leary wet dream. Jake Roberts was also a highlight. He transformed into one of the top five most memorable heel wrestlers in history. His promos bookending his match at Tuesday in Texas have never really been replicated, for better or worse. Jake delved into a completely new psychological aspect of the business with a psychopathic, calculating persona that is still captivating today, even when most everything around him in the promotion has taken on a tinge of quaintness. Well put. The promotion seemed to be setting into its new-ish persona, with all the bright colors and sanitized themselves enough to stop feeling like those slums in South Africa. When they were painted all over. Hold on, I gotta read this properly. The promotion seemed to be settling into its new-ish persona with all the bright colors and sanitized themselves enough to stop feeling like those slums in South America, where they painted all the buildings in pastel colors so you just didn't notice the rats eating the old man's toes in the street. A good overall year and easy to revisit. Also, a question for you about Jake. He is arguably two or three of the best promos ever, but he never seemed to be put into too many situations where he cut promos in front of a live crowd. And the ones he's most lauded for are always pre-tapes or backstage. It separates his skills from the likes of Dusty, Flair, and Piper. How do you feel the change to mostly live content has hurt his ability to translate in later years, specifically AEW? Interesting. I never really thought about that. I think it's hard to compare because you're right in terms that it separates his skills from the likes of Dusty, Flair, and Piper. But it's hard to compare because he wasn't really given a ton of those opportunities. Unless you want to look at his snake pit segment, which was also good. You know, he cut a ton of promos there. I guess it's funny we mentioned that because I just talked about the promo where he's wearing the Bill Cosby sweater at Survivor Series. That's in front of the live crowd, and that's really good. So I think it's hard. Now, why the transition to live stuff, why did it ever work? Well, I think when they transitioned for him, he was done. Because when he's back in 96, I mean, he's not bad, but, you know, he's not in his prime anymore. And I want to throw one other thing. So specifically to AEW when it comes to Jake Roberts. Because I think Jake Roberts is okay in AEW, but you'd expect him to be better. I'm going to posit that it's because he's in a better place in his life that he's not as good. And I know that might sound weird, because I don't believe that you need to be crushed under adversity to produce good art. I think you can do it without it. But then again, I also think there's a reason why the original Star Wars are the best Star Wars, right? Because it was art through adversity. But I think Jake, during this period particularly, and even maybe his whole early career, he was in a pretty dark place. This is a guy that comes from a dark place. And I think that really shows in his work. I mean, even that WrestleMania 6 promo where he's talking about wallowing in the muck of your avarice. And like, it's a cerebral promo, but it always has this dark and sinister edge. And I think Jake, as the clean and sober guy who's come back from the brink, I don't know if he has that in him anymore. Now, I'll be honest, I'm happier to have Jake alive and in good health and happy than I don't need any more Jake Roberts promos. But I don't know if that's the sole reason, but I think that might be an interesting way to look at it. And it would make sense to me. I know some of my best art's been created when I've been in bad places. So I think I understand it to a degree. So I think maybe that's it. I think he hasn't been given the opportunity in front of the live crowd. So I think that maybe that's why. And now he's just so far removed from, number one, his prime, but also from his darkness to really tap into that, which was the strength of his character. Thank you, Stephen. All right, next category, WrestleMania. JT and I rank this on No Holds Barred, which you can find every, I think it's every other Saturday now on the North South Connection Podcast Network. We have been breaking down, we started last year breaking down what was the best show ever in May, what was the best show ever in June, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We did the whole year. And this year we're tackling who's the best performer in January, February, March. We've done up to May so far. I don't think May's dropped yet, but we recorded it. But yeah, so that's what we've been doing. And we've got a new thing coming up very soon. List-based again, but I think it's going to be a long stretch project. It's probably going to replace our live watches, but I think you guys will like it a lot. So North-South Connection, No Holds Barred on Saturdays. Also on Saturdays, you get From Squared Circle to Silver Screen. That's The Cowboy and Logan. They're tackling movies that either deal with wrestlers or that star wrestlers. And they just tackled Stauber, starring Dave Bautista. Great listen, Cowboy and Logan. Give it a chance. And also on Saturdays, I think it's once a month, is JT's Mailbag. And you'll hear everything on there, from the story of him getting his first starter jacket, which bled to his New York Jets fandom, to him dissecting the summer of punk. It's an all-over-the-place show, but it's a fun listen. And JT does a great job fielding the questions and keeping the show moving and interesting, which, as someone who's doing a solo thing right now, that's so challenging. So it's awesome. And also, I think it runs on Sundays. It keeps getting moved around. It was on Fridays before, but it's in the file for sure. Check out Rank and File, Jordan Duncan. Right now it's Jordan Duncan, and you know, he brings in different people. I've been on it a couple times. Eric Engel has been on it a couple times. Right now they're on a bit of a stretch project doing the greatest television theme show, theme song of all time. That's going to take a couple episodes. When you see Rank and File, download it, because Jordan's a great host, a funny guy, and a fun show. Back to WrestleMania, we ranked it on No Holds Barred, 9th out of 36, so ranks high. I'm going to go to my man Jeffrey Thomas, who says, "I am pleasantly surprised, sir, that 1991 made it so high. I am vested in the weighted metrics you would use in a scenario to keep something like 1991 fairly weighted fairly against its market value. To be fair, WrestleMania 7 holds up big time, more than 6 and 8 as contemporaries. On the negative, the Rockers opener is now old news and shouldn't get the high star rating it does compared to 30 years of openers. This series Aaron George created is your favorite podcaster's podcast to listen to. The depth in which he crawls into to look for the historical content is more than anyone does today. Thank you for your medal-worthy service." Thank you for your service, Jeffrey, and thank you for that comment. I mean, honestly, dude, these are the comments that actually make this show, I don't want to say make it happen, but it validates that it's worth doing, and I really appreciate it. Couple things. So the metrics, so I think I've talked about this a few times, that when I was looking at this, my first systems had a lot more emphasis on in-ring. So you'd get, you saw we had a category called matches, but you'd get like world title matches, and then that would be solely on the star rankings. Intercontinental matches, tag team matches, always based, women's matches, always based on the star ratings. And those were extra categories, right? So instead of having the 12 categories, I believe it was 16 at first. But whenever I did that, the years we just did, so 2015, 2018, and 2016, won every time. They won every single time. And then years like 2019 were like top 10. And I kept looking at it and thinking like, this, it doesn't feel right. There's something wrong here. So yeah, and then once I just removed those, I kept one match category, and I added characters. And that balanced it in a way that seemed to be more reflective. I guess, I mean, look, I'm not going to lie and say I don't have biases, but I think it was more reflective of my tastes, but it also just kind of made sense to look at. Now, everybody's going to have a different anybody who ranks this, these years, these 36 years in pay-per-view, they're going to have a different order, and that's fine. I mean, that's kind of to be expected. But this one made sense to me, whereas the other one with all the late 2000s, just because of NXT all near the top, didn't work. That was the big metric change, taking out a couple of match categories and adding in the characters, because everything else is still there. Those are the only things I kind of messed with. I like your comment about the Rockers opener. I love WrestleMania 8 more than 7 myself, but I can see the argument why 7's better. Yeah, I agree with the Rockers opener because for a while that was one of the better openers. And I still think it's good. I'll get to it. For me, I agree with Jeffrey. This is a, I think this is a sneaky under the radar WrestleMania. We rated it 9th, right? There's 14 matches on this show and it feels like it flies by. So the opener is the Rockers against the Faces of Fear. So Haku and Barbarian. And I still think it's a ton of fun. And I agree, it has been surpassed in terms of great openers at Mania. So I did a quick list off the top of my head when I was writing this down. And maybe I'm wrong. Like, if there's anything I missed, let me know. But for me, the ones I have that are better are 10, 23. So, Bret and Owen, the Money in the Bank at 23, the Money in the Bank at 25, Triple H, Bryan, the ladder match at 31, the ladder match at 32, the triple threat at 34 with Miz, Rollins, and Balor, Finn Balor, and the opener of this year's, I guess it wouldn't really count in the rankings since I'm not touching this at all, but I'd say that Drew McIntyre and Bobby Lashley is better than it also. So, 9th, there's 9 ahead of it, which again is interesting because this finished 9th, right, in the WrestleManias. But if you take away the ladder matches and one this year, I think there's only 3 better, and I think it's Bret, Owen, Triple H, and Bryan, and the triple threat from 34. So I think it holds up well. I never looked at it as like an all-time classic. As you can see, it didn't even make my top 5 matches. But I think it's a good opener. It was fun. Next, the Texas Tornado flies through Montreal and murders Dino Bravo. And that joke, so I know, just so you know, that joke's not in bad taste because we all hate Dino Bravo, right? Also, it was only 3 minutes. I figure his murder was probably longer. Bulldog and Warlord fight on every show except the Royal Rumble, and this is their best match. And it's good. Surprisingly good. Easily the Warlord's best singles match. Then the stupid Nasty Boys win the tag titles. Again, the match is good. And then we come to a divisive match, which is the blindfold match between Jake the Snake and Rick Martel. And I remember this match getting all kinds of hate. Maybe it was Scott Keith. I don't know. He was one of the main people I used to read, right? So maybe it was him. But I remember just thinking, like, it's garbage. It's this and that. And I don't get that opinion at all, right? Because for me, if the goal is to engage the crowd in the product, then this blindfold match excelled on every level. The crowd was screaming for Jake, and the way they played everything was perfect. Plus, I think they did a really good job building the tension until Jake hit him with the DDT. And as fun as it was to see the crowd going nuts for Jake and rejecting Martel when he was asking for help too, and was trying to get them to be silent, Martel is so the star of this match. His body language, I don't think he gets enough credit for how good his body language is. Like every movement, and it's similar in the Rumble, right? But his body language is so good. The way he tries to quiet them, he's getting so frustrated. He's mad with the noise. He's upset no one will help him. The missed elbow drop when Jake goes down, he tries to drop the elbow and he misses. I don't think Jake's there, but I love that. I love that he bends over for the back body drop and Jake just runs around him. I think it kind of exposed the business. Like, why can't anybody do that all the time? But I just think it's, and he's so angry with himself because it doesn't work. And I love Gorilla chastising him for it. Like, oh, come on. You got to be smarter than that. And even Bobby is like, I know. Bobby has to like agree with him. I know. Like he's making bad mistakes kind of thing. He smashes the pole with the chair. I don't know. Like it's not a wrestling match, but it's freaking fun. I'm not sure how you could hate it. It's unique. It's fun. Memorable. And I really think there's good performances in it for what it is. Undertaker then murders Jimmy Snuka to start the streak. I guess it's really cool to see Jimmy Snuka on the other side of the murder ledger, which is good. Warrior and Savage have that all-timer. Demolition fights some Japanese guys for no reason. Bossman and Perfect, perfectly fine match. It failed to climax the Bossman and Bobby feud, really, though, because it was supposed to be rude. Quake fights Valentine in a special no one gives a shit match. LOD obliterates Power and Glory. I'm going to say I think Virgil DiBiase, their match at Mania, is the lesser of their series, but it's still pretty fun. My enduring memory from the match, though, is Roddy screaming, "Get up, Virgil! Come on, Virgil!" doing all that bullshit on the outside of the ring. And then Piper gets beaten up. So, like, DiBiase and Sherry just, like, kick the shit out of his hip replacement, right? And Virgil's just having none of Piper staying on the ground, like just screaming at him to get up. And I'm not sure what's more unreasonable for Virgil, him screaming at the Olive Garden staff for more breadsticks or like yelling at this legitimately injured man to get to his feet for some reason. Tito then did his yearly WrestleMania job, this time to the Mountie. I guess that's why he went back to his roots. And then Hogan and Slaughter, I think their match is really damn good. And it's kind of forgotten to time. But it's a good fight. And I think, all things considered, Hogan's probably the right guy to end this traitor's life. So the show's really great. And I think what's crazy is it could have been even better, right? And I think if you're going to make this show better, it's just all in the tag division, right? Because, I mean, maybe if Rude stuck around, that might be more interesting. But, you know, that's not there. But just using the pieces you have, I don't understand why you don't do Demolition LOD here to blow off the feud. I think you also could have done Power and Glory against the Hearts instead of the Nasties. I think that would have been more interesting. I maybe just got like Power and Glory more. Or if you're not going to do that, you could have the Rockers get revenge on Power and Glory. I don't know if that would have been a better match than Hakun and Barbarian, but it would have had a better storyline for sure. Maybe the Hakun Barbarian could have fight the Japanese guys. Or, you know, there's a bunch of things you could have moved around there. All that to be said, the show's good. They're tiny changes. And if these are the only changes I can suggest, that's how good the show was. World title storyline, 10th out of 36. So I feel like we're firmly in the era where the world title feels like the absolute most important thing in the world. When Savage sneaks up and smashes Warrior with that fucking giant scepter and the beads go everywhere, then Slaughter drops the elbow, the announcer's like, no, no, not like this. Like, it's the end of the freaking world. The guy from Iraq beat the invincible Warrior. And then you get the biggest star of all time chasing Slaughter. And I think Hogan does a really good job holding down the title until there's a hot up-and-comer that comes up, and then he loses the title. The world title is also so important that they even add a pay-per-view because the issue isn't resolved at Survivor Series. Now, listen, I know they added it for money. I'm not stupid, right? But here's the time where they were trying to explain why there were extra shows, right? If you ever wondered how far Jack Tunney will go to protect Hulk Hogan, look no further than him watching him throw human remains into The Undertaker's eyes. Only that gets him stripped of the title. Human remains. I mean, look, I guess we shouldn't put too much stock in Jack Tunney's opinions. This is the man who accepted Jake Roberts' explanation that the snake attack was indeed an accident and that the snake was devenomized by the lab. That whole scenario to me, like, so where did Jake, number one, where did Jake get this giant cobra, King Cobra? Did he bring it to the lab in his car and say, listen, lab, can you please devenomize this snake? That snake better have been devenomized. Mid-card storyline, 15th out of 36. I think we're middle of the road here because I love Mr. Perfect. And, you know, he's not presented, though. He's presented kind of as a goof, despite being one of the more memorable Intercontinental Champions of the era. And then they transition the belt to Brett, and it's great. I don't know, though, if Brett was quite there as a character yet. Not that he wasn't over or deserving of the championship, don't get me wrong. But I don't know if he'd had the time to develop into like a single star with his own unique personality and character yet. Whereas the Intercontinental Champions of the past had time on their own to develop. I mean, look at Perfect. Perfect had the feud with Hogan before he was Intercontinental Champion, right? Before that, Warrior had a bunch of time before. You know, Rude, Honky, kind of, yeah. Steamboat, like they all had a history, right? Whereas Brett had the tag history. So again, I'm not shitting on Brett. I just feel that like because that's like they had to do the character work when he had the belt. I think by 92 he gets it, but I think the last half of the year the division feels just a bit stale. Now every single other feud that happens throughout the card is a strong mid card feud. It's not like today where the company has matches just because it's Monday, Friday, and Sunday, right? Jake and Martel feels like it's stupid, but it works. Bobby fucking with the boss man, even though it doesn't get a real climax, it's a feud. Like, I don't understand why Boss Man 2 would be satisfied with that ending at WrestleMania. Like, he didn't even get to beat up Bobby. Bulldog and Warrior, or not Warrior, that'd be a good, I wouldn't mind that match. Bulldog and Warlord fight over who's the strongest. Again, I love the simplicity of the feuds. They just work. Right. And this was an era where these characters are all about to transform and a lot of them go on to become main event players. And that's the kind of thing we see every other Wednesday on New Gen on a Mission. Right. Justin Pratt, my man, Justin Pratt, Tim Slomka, breaking down Survivor Series 92 until Survivor Series 97. And they're going into everything, man. They're not just doing pay-per-views and big shows. They're doing Superstars. They're doing Raw. And they do it in a way that, I mean, like, if I told you someone's doing Superstars, you might be like, oh, I don't want to hear this because it's, you know, it's just jobber matches. But they do a great job breaking into the characters. And the last episode I listened to was all about Brutus the Barber Beefcake coming back. So that was a lot of fun. But give them a chance. New Gen on a Mission every other Wednesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. And really delving into a really cool transitionary period in the company. Tag Team Storyline, 8th out of 36. I mean, look, this year is all about LOD getting crowned and the Rockers breaking up. And since they stormed into the promotion the year before, the LOD has run roughshod over every single team that has been in their path. Then the Nasties win the title at Mania, and you know they're just keeping them warm for Hawk and Animal. The win at SummerSlam is like a great all-time moment. Hawk and Animal, they look like they care, right? But it felt like the future of the division. Like, because, you know, because again, in Canada, we didn't have WCW, NWA, you know? We had the AWA, but again, I wasn't watching it. Maybe I should have. What is in the Road Wars? But we didn't know who they were, and I was only seeing these guys in magazines, like in the PWIs, like these guys with the spikes and like the mohawks and like the spider paint. Like, they look so cool. And then they came. And when they came, I should probably rephrase that. And then they arrived. And, you know, they were just so cool and different. And I'm like, oh, this is the future of the division. Meanwhile, the slow build of tension between Michaels and that no good Marty Jannetty was really well done. They kill it at Rumble. They kill it at Mania. They're mysteriously left off the SummerSlam. And by Survivor Series, they're at each other's throats. The tag team specialists are no more by early next year. And Sean's on his way to the main events. Marty's on his way to banging his own daughter. But I think the whole scene is fantastic throughout the year. So you have the Hart Foundation, the Legion of Doom, the Rockers, the Orient Express, Power and Glory, the Nasty Boys, the Bushwhackers, Demolition, the Beverly Brothers. Listen to that division. Now, it's cool because, like, there's main event teams, there's mid-card teams, and there's jobber teams. Now, I don't think it's the glory days of the 1980s tag team scene in the WWF, but it's the end of it. Money, Inc. and the Natural Disasters are right around the corner, waiting to rear their ugly heads and drive the Warriors into the hard, stern arms of a fucking puppet. Women's storyline. I have it at the median, 16. It's 16 out of 30. It's 16. It gets 16 points because there's no women's action this year, so they get the median score. But I would take this opportunity to talk about how awesome Sensational Sherry is in 91. She doesn't wrestle, but I mean, she feels like one of the most important characters on the show. She offers to blow Warrior in exchange for a title shot at the Rumble. She not only joins Ted DiBiase, but ends up on the same night becoming one of the most important parts of one of the biggest happenings in that the Savage and Elizabeth reunion. And I don't think the Elizabeth return feels nearly as special without Sherry's viciousness. And at SummerSlam, she's fighting to screw over Virgil. I mean, she's everywhere. Like, they transitioned her really well. And she was just so effective at drawing that heat. And I'll always love, too, how her craziness just matched Savage's. Like, they were perfect together. I would dare say they were almost as perfect as Savage and Liz. Royal Rumble match. If you like the Royal Rumble, JT and I, every other Monday that runs with this show, we're doing Now Entering the Royal Rumble. We're starting from the beginning. We chose Bret Hart because he's the first ever entrant in the Royal Rumble. And we talked about each of his Royal Rumble appearances. Next was Tito Santana, all of his. So on, so forth. We are breaking down every single performance in Royal Rumble history. We're ranking them all against each other, trying to find the greatest Royal Rumble performance of all time. Come on, we know what it's going to be. It's 1992. But we're also trying to see who is the greatest cumulative Rumble performer of all time. So it's a fun project. It's a deep dive. I mean, no one's ever deep dived more into Danny Davis than we did. That runs every other Monday. Now entering the Royal Rumble. We didn't rank this one together. I had this match ranked 26th out of 34 Royal Rumbles. It's a hard one to watch. All right. Rick Martel is a beast in this one, though. He is excellent throughout. And it's not just he's the Iron Man. Like I mentioned earlier, the body language, the facial expressions, the crawling underneath guys to avoid Jake, everything just clicks. And he's active the whole match. He fights everyone, including, shockingly, Tito Santana. He rips off Hogan's shirt. Christ, he even eliminates Neidhart after being in there for 50 minutes. There wasn't one moment in the match where he wasn't entertaining. I don't know why the company decided to fuck with Greg Valentine in this match. They throw him out there for 40 minutes. They barely say anything about him at all. And then barely say anything when he gets thrown out. Plus, he doesn't even get to be the Iron Man. This is a hard one to rewatch for now entering the Royal Rumble. Because there's so many guys in there for so long that are doing nothing. Tito Santana's in there for 30 minutes. That was rough because he does nothing. I think I ranked him really low because he does nothing. Davey Boy Smith is in there for 37 minutes. He does a bit more. And Jesus Christ, is there any conceivable reason why Hercules is in there for 38 minutes? It's for sure the longest match of his career and no doubt contributed to his untimely demise. Shane Douglas is in there for 26 minutes. I can't wait to look at him. Never seen again after this match. Everyone's just in there too long. The ring is too full, and it's filled to the brim with people all the time. Like, and what is more surprising? If in your mind, what is more surprising? That Brian Knobbs is in the final four of this thing? Or that black people still watch the WWF after seeing Saba Simba in action? I suppose they had to go with Hogan as the winner, because you have to have the big good guy win after giving the world title to the guy who's not only a fucking traitor, but has like the worst finisher in company history with the moose knuckle to the temple. Historical importance. 8th out of 36. Bret Hart comes of age. Hulk's last big main event run. The start of the streak, which becomes one of the most important draws in the company. I mean, all the dark stuff with Jake and Undertaker, there's that kind of turn. It's not like it led to more dark stuff, but I mean, it's still really interesting. Sid debuts. Well, we don't get his best stuff till later, but he's there. We get the first non-Big Four pay-per-view. I mean, I don't really count the wrestling. Is it Challenge? Classic. That's it. But look, I think the big thing is it all pales in comparison to Ric Flair signing with the company. And like, if you're on Twitter now, you'll come across people saying like, you know, if there's a crossover between AEW and WWF, what would it be? And what would it be like if Roman Reigns fought Kenny Omega? That's a dream match. And it's like, sure, I bet that'd be a really good match. But let's not compare that to the hype in the 1980s of what if Hulk Hogan would fight Ric Flair. I feel like Pro Wrestling Illustrated would run like semi-annually like articles demanding to know who would come out on top, right? And then you match it down and like, who's the real world champion? Who's better? And then Bobby Heenan shows up with that belt and challenges Hogan. And they actually present Ric Flair as a wrestler coming from another promotion. They didn't turn him into some sort of a rooster or name him Ric Bear or some other shit like that. He comes in as a credible world champion. The real world champion, actually. The Golden God. The promo he cuts on Hogan says, "Big man, while you were making movies, I was winning world titles." All timer. I mean, Hogan was winning world titles too, but you know, that's neither here nor there. But this is so huge. And I think it's really revolutionary for a promotion that seemed to think it was the only program on television sometimes. But they were best when they had something to work against. You know, NWA was a good competitor for WWF. And you can find all about that on Wrestling Warzone with JT and Chad. They are going through the Monday Night War era. They started in late 95. My goodness, the last episode I listened to was JT, Chad, and their guest, Jenny Smith. Give Jenny Smith some love too. She's amazing. Check out the Jenny Position. All kinds of fun stuff on there. And JT, Chad, and her talked up International Incident. So a nice little tie-in to my man, Sid. Give it a listen. It runs every other Thursday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. And usually that runs in tandem with ECW Three-Way Dance, which is JT, John D'Amato, and Jenny Smith going through ECW. It's on a hiatus, but it's coming back. So Thursdays on North-South. I mean, look, Wrestling Warzone's a great anchor for the entire network. If JT and Chad didn't want to do that, I don't know. Who knows if this whole thing even would have come together. And it's not just that it's a legacy thing. It's good too. So give it a shot if you haven't already. SummerSlam. 8th out of 34. And this is another show I watched, my God, 100,000 times in the 1990s. It opens with a traditional six-man thingy in the vein of the Rougeaus and Martel against the Rockers and Santana from 89. We get Slick's crew of Power and Glory and the Warlord against the fucking superpower team of the British Bulldog, the Texas Tornado, and a living, breathing dragon. It's a fun opener. Then Bret and Perfect do their thing. Lord Alfred Hayes gets stretched into oblivion. The Natural Disasters and the Bushwhackers go on next. And not even the excitement of Andre the Giant hobbling around on crutches can elevate this to good. Virgil gets an all-time great moment. He wins the million-dollar championship from Ted DiBiase. The crowd goes insane. It's far and away the high point of Virgil's career. And then we get the jail. The jailhouse match, man. This thing. Oh, I love this thing. It's incredible on so many levels. So, if you haven't watched it, the context is the Mountie and the Big Boss Man are going to fight to see who the real law and order of the WWF is. Imagine fighting. I need to be the law and order. It's no, I mean, I've shit on this before when people are like, I have the best talk show. I have the best. But this is no stupider. I'm going to be the law and order of the World Wrestling Federation. It's Jack Tunney. He's the only one. But the loser of this match is going to spend the night in jail, which is the premise. And you can't talk about this match without talking about the whole night. And it starts before the match, where the Mountie is on the street beside the paddy wagon next to the cops that are going to bring someone to the jail. And the Mountie's just berating these New York City police. He's calling them hick cops. He's just shitting over them, their profession, and everything about them, how they're garbage. And it's just such a perfect setup for what's about to come. And the match happens. It's good. It's fine, you know. Boss Man eventually wins. And then the classic stuff begins. So after berating the police officer, now the Mountie's at their mercy. You can't do this to me. They drag him to the paddy wagon. And then the show's going to go on, and we're going to keep cutting back to see what's going on with the Mountie and his ordeal. You can't do this to me. Do you know who I am? I'm the Mountie. First, they fingerprint him, but he won't give them. They're trying to fight him. He's like, you want the finger? Here's the finger. And he gives him the middle finger. I think this might be the first middle finger on WWF television. And while he got the finger out, they grab the middle finger and print him, which is awesome. He's screaming. And whenever he walks, he's constantly yelling, you can't do this to me. Like the whole time. No. Ah. They picture him when they distract him. Then they put him in a cell, and there's a man all dressed in leather. And he comes in like, don't you just love the way leather feels against your skin? Now, as a child watching this, I had no idea the implication of this scene. I thought, okay, this guy's going to annoy him all night and pester him. But he was raped, right? Like, the Mountie got raped by that guy. And watching it now, Bobby's deadpan is like, oh, no. Like, it really sells the severity and the ridiculousness of this classic segment. LOD then crushed the Nasty Boys for the WWF Tag Team titles. We kind of talked about that earlier. I love the LOD looks really happy to win. I love when teams do that, or anybody does that. IRS makes his pay-per-view debut and begins his 30-year career of nothing but boring matches. And then he sires the fucking worst. Anyway, the main event is looked down on some as Hogan and Warrior team up to taste the Triangle of Terror. Also, the word triangle for me doesn't imply terror in any situation except maybe the Bermuda Triangle. And I learned about the Bermuda Triangle in a book around this time too, a story where I also learned about Uri Geller and all the ways in which the assassinations of JFK and Lincoln were similar. Anyway, the match is fine. Triangle of Terror is a stupid name. And then there's a wedding. That's how it show ends. Ryan Gray. My man, Ryan Gray. 1991 is always my go-to golden era pay-per-view year to watch. Well, WrestleMania 7 is very underappreciated. Agreed. SummerSlam 91 is my first memory of watching a live pay-per-view as a five-year-old. You were five in 1991, Ryan? Aaron, do you think it's a missed opportunity to not have the Rockers, the Hart Foundation, Demolition, and Legion of Doom all in a separate match at WrestleMania 7 and not pairing them up for more epic matches? Yes! Yes, I do. And I think we kind of touched on that a bit earlier where, how do you do Demolition LOD, Rockers Hearts, or Rockers Power and Glory, or Rockers anybody, right? There could have been some really interesting stuff there. But I do think this ties in nicely to SummerSlam, because SummerSlam 91 is a great show top to bottom, but it's crazy that it could have been even better. Because you bring up the Rockers, Ryan. How are the Rockers not on this card? Right? And neither are Jake and The Undertaker. Man, you sub out that lame triangle and plug in Taker and Jake against Hogan and Warrior. Man, this show is much better in a hurry. And then have the Rockers wrestle, I don't know, anyone? Because they're on fire in 91. Worst show of the year. The Survivor Series, sadly. I love the opener. Then we get the awful Sergeant Slaughter apology tour. I actually like the Gravest Challenge, too. I think it's a fine Hulk Hogan match. It's not the best, but far from his worst. And I like the finish with Ric Flair holding the chair for the tombstone. Look like death. Hulk Hogan had an in-ring seizure and then actually took a pin. And I'll always love the image of Undertaker leaving the ring, dragging the belt behind him. Then you get the tag Survivor Series match, which, I mean, you know, whatever. It was the Rockers breakup. That was important. You get the 3-on-3 finale, which sucked because, like, the most not that I don't want to shit on the LOD because or the Boss Man. I like them both. But the most important guys or the most interesting guys were not on the card anymore. Jake and Sid, right? So, you know, just it started well, but just wasn't a great show. Speaking of not great shows, we're watching TNA, which is, sometimes it's great, but a lot of times it's not great. On TNA Never Dies, which is myself, JT, and Jenny Smith, every other Tuesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. We started at the very first TNA Weekly pay-per-view. We're now into 2003. Vince Russo is running roughshod. BG James is haunting my fucking dreams. So if you want to see me slowly lose my mind, TNA Never Dies every other Tuesday. And that runs in tandem with the Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast. That's Jake Williams bringing in guests talking about the Ruthless Aggressive era. The most recent episode, he brought in Bob Colling. He's been writing forever, Bob Colling. And I mean, I even wrote some stuff for him long, long time ago. Super cool guy. And Jake's an awesome host. They were talking about this fallout from SummerSlam 2002. But again, it's an era that's not talked about enough. So give it a listen. North-South Connection. The best show of the year. It's a tie. I think it's a tie between WrestleMania and SummerSlam. I think both are great. And we've talked about both. So I'm going to give the nod to WrestleMania for having the best single match of either of them. But I don't think you can go wrong at all. Rocco Martone. Here we go. After watching wrestling as far back as I can remember, 1991 was the beginning of a wrestling sabbatical for me. Oh, Rocco. This was not based on the quality of the product, but I was 14 years old, and I'm pretty sure I would have watched, but I could not see the TV screen past the constant puberty boner that had consumed my life since the end of ninth grade. Well, Sherry was there, Rocco. I still kept up on my favorites like Jake Roberts and Randy Savage, but pay-per-views were in my rear view, and my wrestling consumption was through magazines and the occasional television. I later caught up on all these shows when I started watching in the late 90s. Speaking of Savage, his character went on a wild journey this year, from paranoid megalomaniac to marrying the most incredible woman in wrestling history. Is she? I guess. Yeah, I guess. I feel like, I mean, like, if you did a fuck, marry, kill with Elizabeth, I think she'd always be the marry, right? Yeah, for sure she would. I felt like, back to Rocco, I feel like Savage is the heart of the WWF. That's a really good take. Hogan may have been the star, but much like Dwight, don't compare Randy Savage to Dwight Schrute. Much like Dwight Schrute in The Office, when you watch the entire story, you realize that the story was about Savage all along. Other examples I can think of are Mac from It's Always Sunny and Ron Swanson from Parks and Recs. Yeah, you can't go wrong there. Although after all those characters finally had their triumphant redemption, none of them were attacked by a fucking cobra. Holy shit, was that an angle? I love Rocco so much. People love to call back to the Attitude Era days of WWF and shit on the so-called PG era. Don't forget, this crazy shit was a family-friendly era. Animal attacks, jealousy, resentment, marriage, the nature of friendship, redemption. These are just a handful of the topics explored during Savage's run here. I'm laughing because it's funny. Like, the way it's written, I find it's funny, but like it's right. And that makes it even funnier. The idea that the late 2000s and the WWE thought that the PG meant JBL is poopy, graffiti, and grown man dressed like a third grader being the hero of the company is just mind-boggling. Intelligent and emotionally resonant stories don't need blood and thongs to appeal to adults, just like juvenile humor and fart jokes are not needed to appeal to kids. This is a great point. Man, I hate the criticism of WWE when people are like, oh, you know, you just don't like it because it's PG. Like, no, man. Like, because PG can be great. Like, there's great years up and down. Like, I would say WWF is PG probably till 97, right? And maybe 96, 97. Even if we go to 96, right? WWF is PG until then. And there's tons of great stories in there because it's exactly what Rocco's saying there. It's just about crafting emotionally resonant stories. It doesn't have to be anything other than PG. Like, Look, I'll go back to Star Wars. Star Wars can be PG and still be a great story. Most of the Marvel movies are PG. Great stories. They have emotionally resonating moments, right? It's that, yeah, it's exactly this. Is that, like, people equate now that PG for WWF means JBL is poopy. It's so stupid. It's such a stupid thing. Oh, you just don't like it because it's not PG. Oh, you think, like, no, it's that it's bad. That's the problem. All right, back to Rocco. Sorry, Rocco, I went on a rant. Back to Rocco. It's interesting to have this year after the Bayley-Sasha year. The feud and the two big matches elicited a ton of emotion based on the pure display of athletic story and real-life barrier breaking. Yeah. When I watch the Savage Liz storyline, it culminates in the wedding. That isn't a particularly great piece of writing or an action-filled segment, but you know the characters in the story. Wow, it's pure perfection. It wrings as much emotion out of me as almost any other moment in wrestling. Savage masterfully tells us everything he's gone through in his WWF career and his relationship with Liz in just a few carefully enunciated words. Yep. Aaron, did you incorporate wrestling into your wedding or any pop culture stuff? So, not the actual wedding, but we had a rehearsal in the morning because we had our wedding on a beach. And so my wife went down to the beach to get ready for the rehearsal. And my buddy and I decked out, my best man and I decked out in full Ultimate Warrior garb. So long wigs, painted face, tassels, we had muscle suits instead of the little Speedos. And we went down to the beach, speeding down these roads with the Warriors music blasting out of the car. And I hit the beach with the Warriors music blasting out of the windows. We ran out of the car. We ran around. Yep, that was my wedding. I know weddings are fairly common in wrestling. But do you think other ceremonies will enter the pantheon, like baptisms or bar mitzvahs? I think there'd be a really, you know, they've always tried to do these like super religious characters. And I think that's when you do the baptisms. You have them baptizing guys to kind of get. Bar mitzvahs are tough. When do you get bar mitzvahed? When you're, is it 13 or 14? They're not very good with kids. It's usually Ted DiBiase beating the shit out of him with his bodyguard. Or you find out the guy's not actually his dad. But I think baptisms has some legs. Some other ceremonies. Maybe we could put some divorces. Some knightings. Maybe that we could do some of that. Back to Rocco. Also, as a Canadian person, what was your feelings on the Hogan Slaughter story? Did you even know about the war before the angle? What was your knowledge of U.S. politics then, and how much do most Canadians know about American politics and history? Oh my God, I could write a fucking essay about this. Look, for me, I didn't give a shit that Slaughter joined the Iraq. It never felt like it was too far. I guess we were involved in the Iraq War, but I was also 11. Did I know about the war? Yes, I was at camp. A weekend camp for school when they had told us we were going to war and everybody got really scared. What was your knowledge of U.S. politics then? Zero. Maybe I saw Saturday Night Live with the impressions and that's when I knew it was who. I remember in 92 thinking Ross Perot was really cool. So, and how much do most Canadians know about American politics and history? Okay, those are two things. History, you would have had to have sought it out. So like, you know, I know probably about as much about American history as you know about Canadian history, if you haven't looked it up. I think that's probably a fair, and while our histories are similar, they're also, the details are different, right? I was never brought up knowing the dates of the War of Independence or the Civil War. These things weren't, you know, important. I didn't know what 1776 was until maybe in my 20s, you know? It just wasn't a thing that we needed to know, right? What do most Canadians know about American politics? Well, they think they know a lot, but I find it actually quite gross how, like, there are so many Canadians that think they know better than the actual citizens of the state. I'm not trying to suck up to my American listeners, but it's like, how dare you tell Americans who they should vote for? Like, fuck right off. Like, whatever. All I know is since the last election, my gas is more expensive. No, but I think there's a big arrogance from a lot of Canadians about how we think we're better than the states. And I think it's bullshit. Again, I'm not saying this to suck up. I just think that, like, there's advantages and disadvantages to living in either country. And to look down on an entire country of people, much less our neighbors, because of anything politically that's happening or not happening or whatever, or things that you don't even really understand. Like, I mean, like, I bet most Canadians couldn't tell you what a governor does, right? So, yeah, I hate the way my Canadian brethren look at other countries because we have our own problems. Ryan Everett. Hey, Aaron, looking forward to the pod. Pod always gets backed up on Monday. Oh, Pod Feed always gets backed up on Mondays with this or now entering the Royal Rumble. This was my first year of fandom. Nice. I started watching late 1990, and when I saw Rick Martel blind Jake the Snake, WrestleMania was my first live pay-per-view I ever watched. We're at my uncle's, and the pay-per-view feud didn't come in until the midway through the blindfold match. Oh. As a five-year-old, I didn't care about work rate or psychology. I just figured if me and my cousins yelled loud enough from Chicago, Jake would be able to know where Martel was and hit the DDT. You did it, Ryan. You did it. Then there's the Ultimate Warrior Macho King match. As a five-year-old, this was my favorite match. As a 15-year-old, when I got the WrestleMania tape collection, it was my favorite match. 2 years ago, it was still my top match for the GWWE match poll. The match and the aftermatch are absolutely perfect. And in my mind, Savage and Liz walk away and live happily ever after. Okay, personal feelings aside, quick hits on each show. Royal Rumble. First Rumble to show the undercard. First Rumble to show that the undercard could have good, great matches and important stuff happen. Sorry, Dino Bravo, weightlifting record. Hey, come on now, Ryan. Canada's strongest man. You know how much we know about your politics. All right. With the roster of the Rumble, it should have been better. Yeah, just too many guys standing around and not doing anything. Yeah, we'll chronicle that for you, Ryan, on the Rumble. WrestleMania, great opener, great main event, and all-time classic mid-show with plenty of fun sprinkled in. SummerSlam, one of those shows, kind of like another MSG SummerSlam, 1998, that works better as an all-around show than just looking at the matches in a vacuum. Yeah, that's a good point. Although the Mountie vignettes throughout there are great by themselves. Yeah, those will never get old. You can't do this to me! Survivor Series 91, great opener, big title change, and then an hour-long commercial for Tuesday in Texas. This Tuesday in Texas, Savage Jake always struck me as too quick, but oh my God, did he just slap Elizabeth? Don't get why they didn't include Piper Flair on the pay-per-view and kept it as a dark match. I'm curious what the ending of that match was. Maybe that was why. Random moments, Fred Kitao, Dino Bravo running laps around the ring before his WrestleMania 7 match. Need to warm up. Sherry offering fellatio to the Ultimate Warrior on the interview stand. Hulk forgetting Saddam Hussein's name during a Rumble promo. How could he forget his name? Lord Alfred interviewing Stu Hart at SummerSlam and then immediately pulling the microphone away when he starts to answer. Thanks, Ryan. That's awesome stuff. I love the personal touch. My first pay-per-view was the Rumble 92, and I'm sure I'll talk about it when we do 92. But yeah, like you'll always remember that first time. I remember it more than my first other times of doing stuff. All right, five worst wrestlers, five best wrestlers, then we're out of here. Number five, worst wrestler, the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich. It's just another one of these years where it's not really most of their fault they end up here. So normally, to qualify for best or worst wrestler, I usually state that they have to be in a quarter of the shows. So if, you know, in 2019, there's 20 shows, they had to be on five of them, right? But that's harder when there's few pay-per-views. So in these ones where there's only five pay-per-views, I say they only have to be on two shows. So, you know, these are the guys who are going to qualify here. The Tornado's got two matches. The IRS, he's in the bad Survivor Series match that we talked about earlier. And then he's fighting Dino Bravo, right? He's overstayed his welcome in the Rumble. It's not a great year. Number four, IRS. Look, as long as he's wrestling on pay-per-views, he's going to be in these lists. Number three, Colonel Mustafa. The guy can barely walk. He's a constant threat to humble everyone backstage if he can catch you. You just have to be spry. You can get away from him. Number two, the Repo Man. So he's got a nonsensical match with the guys from Japan, a smash, then a nonsensical tradition to like a Hamburglar sort of character. And then he's got a pretty rough match on pay-per-view teaming with Ted DiBiase. Number one, I have a three-way tie. Tito Santana, Skinner, and Earthquake. Whatever. Tito deserves better. Skinner shouldn't be there. And Earthquake starts the natural disasters, which helps destroy the tag division for the next year. Plus, Earthquake murdered the snake and turned it into a hamburger. With pet murder as the highlight of the year, it might be the time to hang it up. All right, five best wrestlers of the year. Let's do the five best wrestlers of the year. Number five, a tie. I know. But I had to because it's David Boy Smith and the Warlord. How could I split them up? They're joined at the hip for the entire year in some sort of hoss fest. But it's fun for the whole year. By the time we get to Tuesday in Texas, it's a bit played out. But listen, look, I need to know who's going to stay standing after every shoulder block. I need the Bulldog to do that crucifix. And I need Gorilla Monsoon to speculate whether the fingers are locked or not. This is just comfort food. Number four, Jake the Snake Roberts. I talked at length about his incredible character work throughout the year. But this is Jake's best in-ring year on pay-per-view as well. He's good in the Rumble. I think he's great in the blindfold match. Then he goes off the deep end, and he closes the year with an excellent match with Savage at This Tuesday in Texas. Great year from Jake. Number three, Bret, the Hitman, Hart. He's in the Rumble a long time. He's a little underwhelming, but he's good. Fun tag match with the Nasties at Mania. Wins the Intercontinental from Perfect. Participates in the lone good Survivor Series match. And then gives Skinner a shot at the IC title for some reason. I guess he was feeling generous. Bret was always cool. And now he's winning. So it's easier to actually rally behind him and cheer for him. Number two. The Ultimate Warrior. It's funny, eh? Every year. Every year we do these. The Warrior's there. We do these lists. And he's in the top five. And maybe you're going to say that I'm a Ultimate Warrior mark, which is possible, but maybe it's just not that bad. The match with Slaughter at the Rumble is good. The Savage match is an all-timer. And the SummerSlam main event, I think, is fine. I'll pause it again. I think Warrior completely holds his own in all of these matches. They're not carrying him, all right? Instead of carrying him, all these guys are working with one of the most consistent pay-per-view performers that the company's had. In all the matches we've talked about for the Warrior so far, there's two that are bad. Hercules at WrestleMania 4 and Jerry Lawler at Good Friends, Better Enemies. No, not Jerry Lawler, excuse me. Goldust at Good Friends, but Lawler's fine. Everything else is very good to great. 91's no different. And finally, the number one rest of the year, someone else named him the MVP, Macho Man Randy Savage. Man, I can't really talk too much more about how great he is. But he wins his category despite only appearing in two matches. Right? He's so good. If you want to encapsulate how good he is, I mean, we talked about his WrestleMania 7. Go back and listen to that promo after Elizabeth gets slapped. He's blaming himself. That is truly, truly special stuff. He's so, so good. I got nothing more to say about him. He's great. He wins. All right, 1991 is some of the most fun I've had doing this project. It was also one of the last years I watched. So despite the fact that I was potentially burned out, it still scored super high, which should really speak to its quality. 1991 finished 8th place, but only 6 points out of 7, and only 20 points out of 3rd. A better Rumble and slightly better matches, and this one could have climbed, right? I think my personal favorite time in WWE history is probably August 91 to, like, August 92, or maybe just WrestleMania 8, but the company's in such a crazy transition year. I'll always remember the casket and the snake attack. I'll remember Hogan losing the title, and then controversy erupting, and then it gets put up as a prize in the greatest Royal Rumble of all time, right? I remember Jack Tunney saying the snake was devenomized. I remember Vince screaming about the snake. I remember the casket and the tearing. I remember everything about this year so well. The main event scene feels like the most important thing ever. It felt like an extension of the war in Desert Storm. The mid-card gave an incredible support. The tag division was kicking. I don't think we'll ever get another year that takes risks the way 1991 does. It's such a risky year with the storyline leaps and the guys they choose to push. The company doesn't have that level of balls anymore. And I don't know if they have that level of pure wrestling talent anymore. Next time on The Year That Was, we deal with a transitional year that gives us some all-time classics, while at the same time giving us some all-time bad stuff, and not looking like any other year in company history. See you then.